From Alabama to Nevada, Louisiana to Washington, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the latest jobs report shows the U.S. economy continues to gain steam. Stephen Moore of FreedomWorks is here to talk about why the economy is so strong. The government shutdown dominates the news, but nobody is talking about the national debt, which has ballooned to $1 trillion per year. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story. Craft breweries are constantly rolling out new and seasonal products, but for some reason they need federal government approval, and the partial shutdown has put new rollouts on ice. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explains. And Nancy Pelosi and the new Democrat majority in the House want to increase spending and raise taxes. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, has an American Radio Journal commentary on why that would be an economic disaster. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The U.S. economy is growing at the fastest rate in decades and is creating more jobs than there are people to fill them. For a look at the factors behind the red-hot economy, we turn to Steve Moore. Steve is an economist with FreedomWorks. He's author of the new book, Trumponomics. Steve, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Steve, we have had a fourth quarter where the equity markets didn't do well, to say the least, and things have been a bit rocky there. But let's talk about the underlying dynamics of the U.S. economy, and particularly the jobs report that came out last week. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's a blockbuster. It exceeded everyone's hope. We had 350,000 new jobs when include the upward revisions. We now have 7 million more jobs in America than people to fill them. I mean, imagine that. That's more people than live in the state of Indiana. That's how many surplus jobs we have, which is a great problem for a country to have. Wages are rising, which is really important. That means paychecks are fatter for workers. They have more take-home pay. We have the lowest unemployment rate in 50 years. In fact, I wrote my column this week saying that this is the best job market for American workers, probably in 50 years, in a half a century. So all really good news. Construction is good. Manufacturing is good. It's funny, I heard Elizabeth Warren last weekend in Iowa saying, we need to have an economy that works for the middle class. I'm like, what is she talking about? What planet is she on? I mean, we have the best economy for the middle class today in at least 20 years. And by the way, we also achieved 3% economic growth for the first time in 15 years. We never got 3% growth under Obama in 8 years. And then Trump's second year in office, we got 3% growth. So something is going radically right with the U.S. economy. Now, I am worried about the stock market because it's been so herky-jerky. It's recovered a little bit so far in 2019. But I think that there are a couple of concerns about the economy going forward right now.
As we look at that jobs market, Steve, is one segment of the workforce benefiting over others, or is this strong job market also benefiting particularly minority communities?
Well, that's a great point. And first of all, it's benefiting everybody. I mean, these numbers are so strong. I mean, it's just every industry, with maybe a couple of exceptions, but almost every industry is benefiting. The really interesting thing about this particular economy we're in right now is the jobs that are coming back are the blue-collar jobs. That, remember, I don't know if you remember this, but about a month before the election, Obama was saying, how is Trump going to create all these manufacturing and construction jobs? Is he going to wave a magic wand? Well, maybe he's got a magic wand because they are back big time. We've created almost 1 million additional manufacturing and construction jobs. I was in the Midwest about a week ago, and I'm driving down the highway. I honest God's truth, I see a big billboard that says, come work for our manufacturing firm. You don't even have to pass a drug test. Well, that tells you how strong the labor market is when companies are saying you don't even have to pass a drug test to come work. But that's how desperate businesses are to find workers today. And so, and the Wall Street Journal had a report a few weeks ago saying that the biggest wage gains have been for the lowest income and the middle income groups. So we're actually getting the big increases in the paychecks for the people at the bottom, which is exactly what we wanted to have happen. When I wrote the plan with Larry Kudlow for Donald Trump, he always said, how is this going to benefit, you know, middle-class America? Well, by doing the stuff he's done, the tax cuts, the deregulation, promoting American energy, all that stuff is working in spades.
You, of course, are author of the new book, Trumponomics, so you've really researched and written extensively about why this is working. How important were those tax cuts, Steve, in terms of spurring this economy?
Yeah, well, the person who has to read my book is Alexandria Cortez, because she just went around the country saying we should have 70% tax rates. I don't know if you saw her interview with 60 Minutes, but that's the new lunatic idea of the left. You know, let's have the highest taxes in the world. That'll get jobs in America. And so Trump, of course, has done the opposite. He's trying to give America the lowest tax rates in the world so that we attract businesses and capital to the United States, not repel them. And so, yeah, the tax cuts, I think, were really critical. As you know, Larry Kudlow and I really helped put it together for Trump during the campaign as his senior economic advisor. So we really tell the story in the book about how Trump did it, how these things came into effect. I was watching CNN the other night, and this person was saying, oh, the tax cuts have been a disaster. What? Wait, by the way, did you know in 2018, the year just closed, we got more tax revenues into the federal government than any other year in American history? So how is the problem with the deficit a problem of revenue when we have more revenues than ever? It's an overspending problem. Everyone knows that.
Well, typically, a cut in tax rates has usually generated more revenue. I mean, if you go back to Coolidge, Kennedy, Reagan, this is something that normally occurs. A lot of us think that's one of the reasons why the Democrats opposed it, because they knew it would work. So you have these tax cuts. What about regulation, Steve? I know in talking with business owners, there was, especially during the Obama administration, a lot of concern about regulation, where regulation was going. There was almost a collective sigh of relief when Donald Trump was elected. Has his efforts at cutting regulations also spurred this job growth?
Oh, for sure. I mean, and that may even be a bigger factor than the tax cut. I think they're both important. But when I talk to small businesses and big business, you know, men and women who run our great companies, whether it's the guy who runs the corner grocery store or the guy who runs a Fortune 50 company, they'll all tell you that one of the big factors was, it wasn't just deregulation, it was that, you know, under Obama's administration was anti-business, right? I mean, they were not pro-business. Trump is pro-business. And that has a psychological effect. You know, if you're a businessman or woman and you succeed and you make a profit, God forbid, right? Liberals hate the word profit. Of course, there's no businesses if there's no profit. That somehow the government's going to come along with a billy club and smash them over the head. Now, businesses know, hey, I can go out there and start a business and make money and employ people. And, you know, that's the American dream. And so I think a lot of it is just businesses know that they're not going to get clobbered by government if they dare succeed.
During the Obama administration, Steve, it was often discussed about the amount of capital that was not being deployed by entrepreneurs in this country, the amount of capital that was sitting overseas. Are we starting to see, and have we seen that capital start flowing back in? Is that feeding this job growth?
Yeah, you're exactly right about that. By the way, you get an A in economics today, my friend. That's exactly what's happening. We estimate close to $1 trillion is coming back to the United States. That's a lot of money.
We have been talking with Steve Moore. Steve is with FreedomWorks. He's author of the new book, Trumponomics. Steve, tell us where folks can learn more about you and read your writings on various economic subjects, and also where they can get Trumponomics.
Well, it's freedomworks.org is the affiliation, and we have so much great stuff and so many activists all over the country. And the book, Trumponomics, you can get it at a lot of bookstores or go to Amazon. And it's not an economics book. It's a real book about how Trump thinks and how he operates and how we rebuilt this great American economy.
Steve Moore of FreedomWorks. Steve, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
At the offices of the Club for Growth, Andy Roth is keeping an eye on the government shutdown, what's happening in Congress. Also, we have a major political development this week. We're going to talk about all of that. Andy, good to have you here.
Hi, thanks for having me, Loman.
Of course, the partial government shutdown is the big news, the president going head-to-head with Democrats in Congress. And Andy, all of the discussion has been about what money is going to be spent on. And the wall, of course, is dominating there. But we still have a rather large federal deficit that's getting even larger. Is anybody talking about that?
That's the irony out of all this, or the frustration, is that nobody is talking about it. We are now approaching annual, perpetual trillion-dollar deficits. And on top of that, we're already at $22 trillion in national debt, which is more than the GDP of our country. So whether the media wants to report on it or not, or whether Congress and the White House want to talk about it or not, we are approaching a debt crisis. And instead, we're talking about how we can spend more money on things and not figuring out ways to cut it. Trump, to his credit, put out a budget at the beginning of the year, or at the beginning of last year, and said, here are all the programs that we think need to be reduced or eliminated, and Congress hasn't considered any of it. So there's obviously a lot of reasons why this is happening, but nobody's holding Congress to account. Congress itself is completely dysfunctional. There's zero regular order in the House or in the Senate, regardless of who's in control. And now, with this debate on the border wall, they can't even come to a solution on that because they believe that they will score points with their voters by obstructing rather than trying to come up with a solution. So nothing is working. Everything is broken, and our debt just keeps going higher.
In terms of this government shutdown that's going on, Andy, there's been a lot of discussion about who's going to take the blame for it. Do you think that when it comes to President Trump, he really cares about the blame? Or could this even be a situation where with the Donald Trump Republican base, a lot of his voters are saying, well, we don't really care if the government shut down and we want the wall, so we're fine with it.
Trump is the master at deflecting blame. What I suspect will happen, and you're already seeing it, is that congressional Republicans are going to cave first. Fred Upton, a Republican from Michigan, former chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, very moderate member, he's already publicly announced that he'll side with the Democrats to reopen the government. And I think as this drags on, you may see more and more Republicans do the same. So what ultimately will happen is that the Republicans will cave, the Democrats will win the argument, Trump will blame congressional Republicans, and in no small part, perhaps he should. And then what I suspect will happen after that is that a lot of congressional Republicans will announce their retirement in record numbers like they did last cycle, because they do not recognize, the congressional Republicans don't appreciate the position they've been put in. They aren't able to operate like they used to be able to. Their voters are angry with them because they keep crossing Trump. So they're like, to heck with this, I can go out and become a lobbyist and get paid 10 times as much. It's a very disappointing outlook, but that is what I suspect will happen. The congressional Republicans will cave, the Democrats will win, Trump will blame the Republicans in Congress, and then you'll start seeing a ton of retirements.
Isn't that the point, though, Andy? And it's something that conservatives have been fighting for decades, is to try to elect a more conservative Republican conference that's going to do things like address the debt issue you just talked about, to try to cut back on spending, try to do border security. And the president, of course, famously wanted to drain the swamp. So if Republicans cave and then they leave, doesn't that just sort of achieve the goal?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it is a silver lining, but the only way to complete that silver lining is to make sure that when those vacancies occur, the voters elect true conservatives.
That allows us to talk about a retirement that has already been announced, and this could be a case where conservative Republicans could have a gigantic opportunity. Your home state of Kansas, what's happening there?
Yeah, so Pat Roberts is retiring after a long, long career in Washington. I think it was approaching 40 years, maybe. I think he started in the 80s sometime. This is a perfect example of what we're talking about. Pat Roberts did very little to contribute to reducing the size of government. On his way out, he recently just bragged about how he was able to pass a bloated, ugly-looking farm bill, and he bragged about that. And now, granted, you may think that that's what Kansas wants, but I would reject that premise. I think that Kansans want a responsible, limited government. Now, to your point, we now have an opportunity to elect a strong conservative in Kansas, and frankly, Kansas isn't very well known to elect strong conservatives. This is the state of Bob Dole, Nancy Landon Kassebaum, and ironically, Arlen Specter. Specter was in the Senate from Pennsylvania, but he was born and raised in Kansas. So Kansas does have sort of a moderate streak, but my hope is that we can find a conservative. There are a few names popping around. The big one, the big obvious one, would be the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, who enjoys incredible success dealing with the president, and I think the president would love to have him in the Senate if he weren't already the Secretary of State. So I don't know if Pompeo would make that decision, but he would obviously be the runaway favorite. There are other names being popped up, a lot of local members, Kris Kobach, who recently ran for governor, he might run. Another intriguing candidate is the current Federal Communications Commission chairman, Ajit Pai. That's not a familiar name to a lot of people, but he is a Kansas native, and like Pompeo, he enjoys some success in the Trump administration. So I think we've got a good opportunity here. We just got to capitalize on it.
We, of course, will keep a close eye on all the developments in Kansas as that U.S. Senate race matures. We have been talking with Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. And Andy, a couple of words about the club.
You bet. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 250,000 members from all across the country, from all walks of life, and we're united because we believe in economic freedom. If your listeners are interested, they can go to the Club for Growth's website at www.clubforgrowth.org, and if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, as always, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Craft breweries are constantly rolling out new and seasonal products, but for some reason, they need federal government approval, and the partial shutdown has put new rollouts on ice. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explains.
The ongoing partial shutdown of the federal government, which has now been going on for 3 weeks, means that breweries around the country are unable to get the government's permission to sell new types of beer. And that's not because it's dangerous or unhealthy to make new alcoholic drinks while government regulators are on furlough, but because there's no one available to approve the labels that would have to go on cans and bottles of booze. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a look at this weird kind of side story that's part of the government shutdown, part of the consequences of the government shutdown, and a story that I think raises questions not just about the government shutdown, but also really about what the government does when it's up and running. Because breweries, wineries, distilleries, anybody in this country who makes an alcoholic beverage has to get permission from the government to sell that beverage. And not just to sell it, but they actually have to get the physical labels that are going to go on the cans or the bottles or on the taps maybe that go in bars. All of that has to be approved by an agency called the Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau. That's housed within the Treasury Department, and the Treasury Department is one of the parts of the federal government that's been affected by the shutdown. So that means that the Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau is not currently doing the approvals of those labels for new types of wine and spirits and beers. The TTB's main responsibility is collecting alcohol taxes. And of course, don't worry, they're still doing that during the shutdown, but the Bureau is also charged with ensuring that beers, wines, and spirits accurately communicate details like the amount of alcohol by volume, for example, the ABV that you'll see marked on any bottle of beer. It also makes sure that the labels comply with the mandatory Surgeon General's warning that has to go on anything containing alcohol. And without government approval, the drinks that those labels go on can't be sold. Now, the turnaround time for this pretty routine bureaucratic process is usually pretty quick. It takes no more than a few weeks, but the shutdown has breweries rethinking their plans and even scrapping beers that were already in the pipeline. At the Pennsylvania-based 2SP Brewing Company, Michael Contreras, the director of sales and marketing, tells Philly.com that the brewery has canceled plans to make an Imperial Oatmeal Stout this winter because it was unclear if they would get the label approval in time when the beer is ready. And of course, a beer like that, a heavy, thick beer, that's really a winter beer. If they can't roll that out until April or May, well, nobody's gonna buy it. Meanwhile, at Atlas Brew Works in Washington, D.C., a brand new apricot IPA might have to be dumped right out of the tanks because it's already fermenting, but there's no timetable for getting approval from the Treasury Department for the labels that would have to go on those cans. Other breweries are taking their frustrations directly to the president. Prairie Artisan Ales, for example, was tweeting this week at Real Donald Trump, telling him that we are an American-owned company and we want to distribute a new beer, but the shutdown means that we currently can't do that. Please help, because the people want the beer. So on one hand, this is a story about the government shutdown. It's a story about the ways in which the federal government shutting down affects people and businesses that aren't even really connected to the government in any way. After all, these are breweries. They're private businesses. They're not something that the government does. They're not government services. But I think the better question here is not about whether the government should be reopened just so breweries can get their cans and bottles approved by the Treasury Department, but rather, why is the Treasury Department in the business of approving these labels in the first place? After all, we're not talking about oversight of anything that affects the safety or the quality of the drinks themselves. The TTB's involvement is just one more step that breweries and wineries must take before getting their products to the public, but it's not a step that really does much of anything in the public's interest. The other problem with the TTB is actually a First Amendment one. TTB routinely denies certain labels for alcoholic beverages that would be considered perfectly fine to slap on any other product. For example, if you made perfume and you wanted to name your latest fragrance opium, no government agent would stop you. They wouldn't tell you you can't sell that product. The world's biggest soda brand is named Coke, after all, and a company called Chronic Candy has been making lollipops for years, even though that's a slang term for marijuana. But the TTB has used vague statutes to justify blocking labels for beers that make similar references to drugs in most cases. Maybe the best known, most recent example of this was in 2016, when a Minnesota-based brewery was told that it couldn't sell a beer that it wanted to call LSD Ale. Now, it wanted to put that name on the beer because it was sort of a double entendre. The beer was made with lavender extract, sunflower oil, and dates, LSD. That exact same product ended up being perfectly legal to be sold under the name Lavender Sunflower Date Ale, which is what Indeed Brewing Company ended up calling it, but the TTB wouldn't let them call it LSD Ale. So instead of having to proactively approve every label for every alcoholic drink sold in America, the TTB's bureaucrats could probably be relegated to an enforcement role. For example, breweries and wineries know what information has to go on those labels by law, right? I mean, they know that the alcohol by volume has to be on there. They know the ingredients have to be on there. They know the Surgeon General's warning has to be on there. If they fail to do that, they could be reported to the Treasury Department. The TTB could get involved. There could be investigations and penalties and fines, whatever. But that's how most other government agencies that regulate consumer goods operate anyway. And so I think regardless of how you feel about the government shutdown, whether you think President Donald Trump is making an important stand to get the border wall built, or whether you think that he's shutting down the government over a project that will probably never be completed, it doesn't really matter, because when it comes to the problem that's facing breweries and the problem that is the Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau, this is exactly the type of agency that a shutdown should make us reconsider a little bit or think a little harder about. Because when the TTB is shut down, it causes problems, of course, but when it's operational, it causes problems too. We should probably just get rid of it. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out my latest piece on the government shutdown and on how it's affecting breweries at Reason.com. Check out all of our other coverage up there of the federal government and the ridiculous hoops that it often makes businesses and private citizens jump through. Again, all of that at Reason.com. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
National Democrats are rushing to embrace a socialist agenda that includes higher spending, nationalized health care, and a continued war on fossil fuels. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, explains why this is a prescription for economic disaster on this American Radio Journal commentary.
There is a paradox brewing in the United States that will impact all of us for this year and perhaps decades to come. The more liberals are successful with hurting President Trump's agenda, the more damage they create for themselves, the recovery, and our nation's health. On November 8, 2016, Donald Trump was elected President of the United States. It was an overwhelming upset, which is yet to be accepted in so many quarters in the nation. Beneath the drama playing out in the far left is an economic conundrum that has yet gone unnoticed. On election night 2016, stock market futures plummeted in reaction to the shocking election of Donald Trump. The next day, however, the stock market gained over 250 points and hit a record high during that day. Since that historic day in 2016, the stock markets have risen extensively by almost every conceivable measure, be it the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the NASDAQ Index, or the S&P 500. Almost every commentator and financial expert notes that markets hate uncertainty. They believe that the market was reacting to that uncertainty, and the removal of the uncertainty caused the markets to rise after Trump's election in 2016. What the commentators failed to mention was that markets hate interference as much as they hate uncertainty. The election of Donald Trump marked the end of that uncertainty, as well as the beginnings of the unraveling of excessive intervention in free markets. During the first 2 years of the Trump administration, the regulatory burden on the United States economy and renegotiating trade deals have had a very favorable effect on the creation of wealth as measured by the stock market, employment statistics, and income growth. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed almost to 27,000 in President Trump's first 2 years. Now the conundrum. Since the loss of the U.S. House of Representatives to Nancy Pelosi, the stock market has become incredibly erratic and has dropped by almost 3,000 points. The volatility has exploded. The market is reacting to the uncertainty of the working relationship with the new leadership in the House with the president. The concern centers on how the U.S. economy is viewed by our government. If there is an increase in the regulatory burden, distraction and interfering with the president's agenda, and uncertainty as relates to the Federal Reserve's actions on interest rates, the economic boom will be over. The consequences of this increase in uncertainty, as well as the re-regulation of the U.S. economy in unhealthy ways, will undermine the very economic boom that have benefited liberals significantly. Bubbles and panics happen in markets. Intervention in markets by government happens occasionally. The long-term effects of those interventions are not always so obvious, particularly when the legislative branch does not understand how markets work to begin with. Until the Pelosi and socialists understand that its own policies in the past, no document loans, cheap money, no down payments on home loans, etc., led to the overheated real estate market in 2008, more efforts to remove the pain of economic contractions will be made with the effect of setting the next stage for the next bubble and then its bursting. Pelosi's election as Speaker may have done just that. All of us should be concerned that failing to allow the economy to stabilize through rational market forces will likely lead to an even more disastrous bubble bursting than happened in 2008. If this economy becomes unraveled, and it is in a precarious position, then Nancy Pelosi will have single-handedly led to one of the greatest economic debacles in recent history. Make no mistake, the economy is still recovering from the failed economic policies in this nation for the past 40 years. It is precarious while strong. It will not take much to derail this economic success. The Federal Reserve's actions of increasing interest rates is one thing. The re-regulation of the U.S. economy after decades of massive interference from Washington, D.C. is another. The Northeast and the West Coast states, particularly New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, California, and Washington, which are all blue states, have benefited the most from the policies they hate the most. They will suffer the greatest by undoing the very policies they hate. That's the conundrum. The day of reckoning is coming. What I do know for certain is that markets hate uncertainty and interference. Having spent time in Poland in 1991 and Romania and Bulgaria in 1996, the feelings of euphoria of the masses when they swore off the leg irons of socialism and communism were electric. I pray that we as a nation never have to experience the full wrath of a government-controlled economy. Nancy Pelosi, you have been warned. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KCNW-AM in Kansas City, Missouri, WWNL-AM in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, along with WBRI-AM in Indianapolis, Indiana. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.